There were nine people in and out of the Springfield in that 2-year period of time.
Wow, that's a revolving door.
I mean, every time Neil left or Bruce would have problems with immigration, because there were three Canadians in the band. Steve and I were the only Americans. So every time somebody would leave, you know, we would try and replace him, but it was just almost impossible to replace the original five members. That was really what was the unique group. That was the group that was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In my heart, as long as Steven was in the band, I was going to be in the band, because Steven and I had, you know, a different relationship, I felt, maybe than you know, anyone else. And even though Neil was in and out and Bruce had his problems, as long as Steven was there, I told myself, you know, I'll continue. But when he made, because it was his band, and don't let anybody ever kid you that the Buffalo Springfield was anybody, it was Steven's band. He was the heart and soul of the Springfield.
Greetings and welcome to Life Off Screen. I'm Dan Ruppel. This is my wife, Peggy.
And Dan, my husband here, is so excited about this interview today. So excited.
I rarely use the word giddy, but maybe giddy.
Yeah, giddy yeah. Fits.
Yeah, because I grew up on this gentleman's music. Our guests are Richie and Nancy Ferrer. And Richie is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a member of the very influential Buffalo Springfield. He went on to play with Poco. He had a band with J.D. Souther and Chris Hillman, the Souther Hillman Furry Band. I don't know how they got that name. and then they're going to talk about their journey to faith. And I think you're going to just really enjoy what they have to say.
And especially, you're going to love hearing Nancy's heart, because she's gut level honest about that transition and kind of where she was up to here and the changes they made and what happened when God got a hold of their heart. So stay tuned. You're going
to
love it.
Yeah. So there's lots to talk about. Let's just jump right in. Welcome, Richie and Nancy.
Hey, Dan and Peggy. How are you?
Very good. It's so great to have you.
Thank you so much for the invite. This sounds like something really wonderful that you guys got planned and are doing. It just seems like a great idea. And I just hope that the Lord uses it to some great things for you.
Well, yeah. We're certainly having a lot of fun. And you're there in your home in Colorado. I can't think of really a better place if you have to be quarantined than Colorado.
Amen. I mean,
beautiful.
We understand. I'm looking 50 miles out there to the east right now. It's just beautiful, clear, sunshiny day.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I remember I was recalling the first time we met. I don't know if you remember this, but it was, I'm thinking if I had the date right, it was New Year's Eve, 1978. Mm-hmm. And we were playing the Paramount Theater in downtown Denver. Oh, wow. And it was with Tom Stipe, Calvary Denver at the time. And Isaac Airfreight, my comedy group, was opening. And then you were headlining. As rightly so, and then Tom followed with a message at midnight. And I remember it was the first time I met you. I remember also meeting you, Nancy, backstage. We were chatting before the evening proceeded.
Who knew? 2 years later, just 2 years later, we moved to Colorado, and Dan came on as associate pastor at Calvary Chapel with Tom Stipe, who was a bandmate at one time, right? And and that's where we got to kind of interact with you both more. It was a blessing. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of old home week.
Yeah.
well, what we want to do today is we want to talk about your faith journey, your marriage, your family, etc. But we want to start with your musical journey. So so let's go back. Richie, you're a Buckeye. You were raised in Ohio.
Yes, I am. Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. I was born in L.A., but the entire Ruppel family's Buckeyes.
Really?
Yeah.
They're all from Ohio.
My brother, my parents, all my aunts and uncles are from the Canton area. Canton? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, did you grow up in a musical family? What was kind of your influence or the spark of your musical passion?
Yeah, it wasn't really a musical family. I mean, my mom sang in the church choir. My dad liked music, and that's where I really, you know, got a lot of, I think, my influence, because he would, I don't know, there would just be music on the radio, you know, yeah. And he bought my mom a tape recorder and I confiscated that, you know, and put on the radio and just tape songs and all. But I mean, as far as music, my sister isn't musical, and I don't know where it came from me. It's just something that just burned in my heart, you know, asking mm-hmm. my parents for a guitar when I was 8 years old and
yeah. wow,
wanting to be like Ricky Nelson.
I remember those days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what drew you to like folk music in the early days?
You know, it was mostly the commercial stuff, the Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul and Mary, that type of, it wasn't the esoteric more stuff. It was more the commercial mm-hmm. music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you decided, I mean, the folk scene at that time was New York.
Yeah.
Right.
Greenwich Village. So you yep. move out there. Was that kind of a scary decision to go out to New York?
You know, Dan, I didn't even think about it. It was just something I knew I wanted to do. Our school choir, a cappella choir, was going to take a trip back to New York and do some, do some concerts. And I actually had a ruptured appendix around Christmas time and dropped out of school. And my friends, Bob Harnelink and Nels Gustafson, you know, we'd already got this plan how we're going to go into the village and become the next big thing. And here I am with a ruptured appendix and dropping out of school. And I didn't even know if I was going to get to go. And I finally, talked to the school, and they, as long as I would come up and rehearse with the a cappella choir, they let us go. And so we went to New York in March. And I can't believe it how my friend, not Bob, but Nels, he just got us into these little clubs on a Saturday night when all these clubs had set entertainment, and got us to be able to play. Now, the catch on this whole thing was, got us to play when they turned the audiences over. I mean,
what caveat.
But it hooked me. And so, you know, when I talked Bob and Nels into going back to New York in the summertime, you know, let's go pursue this. You know, it didn't dawn on me. Even coming from a little town in Ohio, man, I mean, I had my sights on, you know, we're gonna be the next thing, whatever it was, you know?
Right.
You know, Dan talks about going into the comedy groups, and he was going down there 15, 16, 17 years old. And you think, where did you get the tenacity to do that? But
it was just like you, it was that youthful confidence that you just thought you could do it.
So out of character for me today. If it would be the same thing that I'd have to make a routine on today, I mean, it would be so far out of character. I don't even like to drive downtown anymore, you know, but leave this little town and head off to New York City. I mean, goodness sake.
Yeah, but while you're there, you make one of the most significant connections of your entire life, really, with Stephen yep. Stills. How did that come about?
He was working in one of the little clubs that we had that we played in March. And when we got back in the summertime, Stephen was playing in one of the little clubs. And yeah, we hooked up and became really good friends.
Yeah. Now the folk scene certainly is starting to gravitate to LA, especially with yes. Mr. Tambourine Man coming out.
Right.
And
right.
it just kind of shifted there. Yeah. I guess what Stephen went first.
Yeah, he did go first. Actually, when we got to New York, folk music was pretty much really dying at the time. And the group that we were in back in New York, when it broke up, we were together about 6 months. And when we broke up, Stephen went to California via mm-hmm. Canada and met Neil Young. I went mm-hmm. up to Pratt & Whitney wow. Aircraft to hand out tools in the tool crib up at Pratt & Whitney Aircraft. But we all maintained a little apartment down in New York, and Neil came in to New York to peddle some songs, and that's where I met Neil. And mm-hmm. But when you mentioned the Byrds, and a friend of mine that lived across the street from me in New York, we lived on Thompson Street, Graham Parsons.
Oh, another legend.
He brought the Byrds' first record up to me when I was working, living with a family up in Connecticut, when I was working at Pratt & Whitney, and he said, you got to hear this music. You never heard anything like it. And when I heard it, it was like, I got to get with Stephen. I got to be making music. This is really what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I got a hold of Stephen and went to California, and that's when we started the Springfield.
Yeah, the California sound.
You do Buffalo, Springfield, and I mean, along with the Byrds, you're probably the seminal, most influential in the whole folk rock, country rock, whatever you want to call it, whatever term you want to put on it. Did you feel at the time we're doing something new, fresh, what would be ultimately influential?
Well, once we got started, I think maybe, you know, we did. The first place that we actually played after the band was formed was the Whiskey A Go-Go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we started, no one knew who we were. There was no one there. But by the time we finished a six-week little stint there as the house band, playing with the Doors, playing with Love, playing with a lot of different little bands that became popular, I mean, people were lined up around the block. And it was amazing. And I think then we started to just think that, you know, hey, we might be onto something here, you know, because it was unique. I mean, we had a pretty unique band.
Yeah,
you did. I mean, I think about the four-part harmonies that you guys really—that was a genesis of so much.
And it was a time when you could just explore and do it. I mean, when you listen to even the Springfield records today, there was so many different types of music that we did. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just one kind of music. It was a conglomerate, you know, of music.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you had real, you know, three real significant musical voices with you, Stills, and right. Neil Young, and which kind of brings me to Epics right now is running a documentary, two-part documentary, Laurel Canyon, and you do some of the narrative early on in the episode, talking about Buffalo Springfield, and then a transition to Poco later. You know, Laurel Canyon was really the epicenter, the flashpoint of this move. What was it about Laurel Canyon, the environment, the diversity of voices combining?
Somehow or another was just the area that a lot of the musicians, you know, lived in. Actually, Nancy lived in Laurel Canyon before we got married. Yeah, she was living there. And I moved in with Mark Volman. I don't know if you know that name.
Turtle.
Or not. Yeah.
Turtle. I saw him with Flo and Eddie at the Golden Bear.
we played with the Turtles, and I was kind of like homeless, and Mark said, hey, come on, man, come up and live with me. It's right around Happy Together time. And Nancy lived just down the street. This is where we met. We met at the Whiskey A Go-Go through a friend. But she lived, she had a little house in Laurel Canyon just down the street from where Mark was.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, I just know watching the doc, I was just I was taken back by so many things, but, you know, beyond even just the musical experience of you guys all kind of gelling together and everybody being located in that area because it was cheaper, there was something about that being in community that helped. You know, it didn't seem to as you seem more collaborative than competitive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I think at the time, I think that was really true. I think we were all for one and one for all. Hey, you know, when Mark brought home the acetate for Happy Together, you know, I mean, I was excited just to sit there. We were having a great time just listening to it, and you know. And so I think you're right, Peggy. We were just kind of all for one and one for all there. It was really a lot of fun. It was a great time to be making music.
Yes, very special. And so Nancy, so where is it that you come in here in this story, moving down the street?
Go ahead, tell a story, honey.
Well, my boyfriend before him told me to go see this really good band at the Whiskey A Go-Go, and I went, and he was there.
She's standing in front of the stage, you know, I didn't want to wear my glasses at the time, but there was this really, really fine looking blonde chick that was just standing right in front of me, man. And I would sing "Sit Down, I Think I Love You" to her every night.
It's awesome.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Nancy, were you born and raised in Los Angeles?
In Granada Hills, in the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah. And what took you to Laurel Canyon?
I don't know. My girlfriend and I we're going to the Sunset Strip, you know, going to clubs and stuff. Actually, I guess the boyfriend that I went with before Richie was a musician. And I think he was the one that introduced me to the Strip. And then we broke up. And then Pam, my girlfriend, and I wanted to move. I only lived in Laurel Canyon for 6 months. I mean,
but it was a good 6 months
to be there.
Yeah, it was 6 months, and the reason I moved home was because he'd asked me to marry him, and we wanted to save money, so I moved back home with my mom.
And your folks weren't skeptical for this musician guy coming on the scene?
Yeah, hippie musician.
So my mom was a little bit skeptical, but the minute she met him, I mean, gosh. I loved him.
Who wouldn't?
Who wouldn't? Who wouldn't?
Yeah. Well. To talk again about Buffalo Springfield, I mean, highly influential, but a very short shelf life. You were together, what, 2 years and what, three albums? Something like that?
Three albums.
Yeah.
Seems
now,
impossible.
So with Jim Messina, you form Poco, which is another seminal group. And did you have a different vision for what Poco should be versus Buffalo Springfield?
Yeah, simply because I think Jimmy Messina and I, you know, we'd become friends, and Jimmy had, I think, a bit of very country influence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the Springfield, you know, there were 9 people in and out of the Springfield in that 2-year period of time.
Wow, that's a revolving door.
I mean, every time Neil left or Bruce would have problems with immigrants, because there were 3 Canadians in the band. Steve and I were the only Americans. Every time somebody would leave, you know, we would try and replace him. But it was just almost impossible to replace the original 5 members. That was really what was the unique group. That was the group that was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Jimmy probably came the closest. He was an engineer of ours at Sunset Sound. And Jimmy and I just struck up a friendship. And so in my heart, as long as Steven was in the band, I was going to be in the band, because Steven and I had, you know, a different relationship, I felt, maybe than you know, anyone else. And even though Neil was in and out and Bruce had his problems, as long as Steven was there, I told myself, you know, I'll continue. But when he made, because it was his band. And don't let anybody ever kid you that the Buffalo Springfield was anybody. It was Steven's band. He was the heart and soul of the Springfield. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But when he left, you know, Jimmy and I, you know, we just, we were on a Beach Boys tour. And we kind of saw things happening, you know, that this isn't going to go much longer. Mm-hmm. And we said, let's just start another group. I had written Kind Woman during that time, and we were looking for a musician to play the steel guitar on that song. And it happened to be a road manager of ours that recommended Rusty Young. And so when Rusty came out and played, then all the pieces started to come together. He brought George Grantham in, who's a singing drummer. And then we were just looking for bass players. And, you know, we auditioned Randy Meisner and Timothy B. Schmidt on the same day.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Wow.
So then once we filled in, you know, that slot, then we were off and running. You probably didn't know that I won't say audition for the band, but kind of we were looking at maybe joining the band was Greg Allman.
Is that right?
Really?
Yeah, he was hanging around town. His brother had gone back to Atlanta. Dwayne had gone back to Atlanta or Macon or somewhere in Georgia.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because almost simultaneously after we had, you know, talking to Greg about, you know, being a part of the band, his brother called and said, hey, you get back out here to Georgia. I got something going on right now. And that's when Greg left and they started the Allman Brothers. But anyway,
okay.
You
didn't
know that, did you?
No, I didn't. Amazing. And you mentioned Randy Meisner and Timmy Schmidt, which in different eras, they went and be the bass player for the Eagles. But there just seems to be all these interchanging parts with all the bands back then. It's amazing community. Mm-hmm. But now you go... You're in Poco through, the Crazy Eyes album, I think, something like that.
Yep, Crazy Eyes was the last one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you hooked up with J.D. Souther and Chris Hillman. Now, at that point, that's when you're starting to struggle, right? In your marriage and life?
Life in general. I mean, I was being driven at the time I was watching a lot of my friends go off to rock and roll success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was really kind of, you know, at that particular time, you needed an AM record in order to put your career in maybe a different mode. And when we released Good Feeling to Know, we were confident that that's the song that was going to, you know, catapult us out of where we were. We had, we, everywhere we played, it was a lot of gymnasiums and colleges and this. We had no problem, you know, drawing people, but we couldn't get radio airplay. Mm-hmm. And right at the time that we released A Good Feeling to Know, Take It Easy came out. And it became just a giant, and I just got, you know, I just became very discouraged. I was, like I said, I was being driven at the time. Mm-hmm. And I called David Geffen, who was a friend of ours at the time. He was working, you know, kind of behind the scenes with us. And I just asked him, you know, hey, look, it doesn't look like this is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And got any suggestions. And that's when he said, you know, Chris is looking for something to do. And J.D. Souther, great songwriter. Mm-hmm. Let's just put together another Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I'm mm-hmm. thinking to myself, that's all there is to it. I've been at this for 6 years. That's all there is to it. You know, so something else is happening. But yeah, that's how, you know, we met. And my life, though, was just falling apart. I had no idea what was going on. I mean, it was just, it was crazy at the time. That's all I, you know, I mean, maybe Nancy would add something to it. I remember SHF was rehearsing over in Aspen, and I had asked, you know, it was like a 2-week vacation for her to come over there, and she didn't even want to go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, and leading up to this, she's become a believer. And I didn't know.
Okay.
I mean, I didn't even know it.
And Nancy, let's pause that. What happened? What was the circumstances of you coming to faith?
Well, in with the band Souther, Hill, and Furay, there was a guy named Al Perkins in the band. That's right. Who led mm-hmm. Richie to the Lord. And he and his wife Debbie gave us tapes and books to read. And in the middle of, I think it was Satan Is Alive and Well, by Hal Lindsey. And in the middle of the book, there's a little, you know, get on your knees and pray. And I did it. And I became a Christian. And our marriage, we were struggling. It was hard, you know?
Yes.
And I thought, ooh, I can get out of this. I'm a Christian and he's not.
No. Escape clause.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can continue now.
Any children at this point?
Yes. And I was pregnant with our second.
Okay. Lots of change.
Yeah.
We had a 4-year-old. Let me see. Timmy would have been 4, I guess, because she's almost 5. Yeah, 5 years. Mm. Yeah, and I was pregnant with her second. And I figured, I hope this other baby is a girl, and I'm just going to leave and, you know, live my life. And then he became a Christian.
Yeah.
And I was very unhappy.
Shucks the darn.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. So
we were rehearsing over, we were in Aspen rehearsing, and Al called me up on, you know, Al had a mode of operation, and he did this over and over again. He would, you know, we'd either invite him over for dinner, he and his wife would invite us over for dinner, and after dinner it would always be, let's pray, and you want to accept the Lord, and it would always be no, you know, and all this. But one day he called me while we were rehearsing in Aspen, and I just heard this little check in my spirit. Tonight's the night. You're going to do it, you know?
Wow.
And he called, and when I called Nancy to tell her that I had accepted the Lord, because by this time, I mean, I knew she had accepted the Lord. I mean, mm-hmm. that was, yeah, there's other things that went up to leading up to this, but there was dead silence on the other end of the phone.
I was so upset.
It was, because now she wasn't able to.
Her escape clause is gone.
Oh, wow. Isn't that something?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when she came over to pick me up, you know, to come back home, you know, because after our rehearsal time over in Aspen, you know, it was the longest ride from Aspen back to Boulder. It was cold. It was just awful. I mean, I don't mean cold weather-wise, because this was the middle of July. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it was cold, and it was there that she just said, hey, I want a divorce. And bingo, that's when I called out. I couldn't even talk to Al. I was so devastated, you know, and he said, well, come on out to California. And, you know, we'll just try and see our way through it. And that's when he took me down to Calvary Chapel, and mm-hmm. I started meeting all kinds of, you know, good friends down there and all. But yeah, it was a tough time. We had been married for 7 years, mm-hmm. and we separated for 7 months. Mm. And wow. it was one of the most difficult times. I think I had every counselor in the world.
Nancy, can I ask you, in those 7 years, seven months, right? What made the difference? What happened in your heart?
The Lord. Because I was just a new believer, but I knew that if I did what God wanted me to do, if I followed God's will, things would work out much better for me, mm-hmm. even though I didn't want to. You know, my heart wasn't in it. Yeah. And I basically willed myself to do what God wanted me to do. And he restored, mm-hmm. you know, my love for him, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't like just flipping a switch.
No. It was months.
Getting started again.
It was hard.
You know, it was a challenge.
God starts healing your marriage. You're both have come to faith, and are you questioning whether to return to music? And if so, do you now as a Christian, are you thinking I need to reapproach music as a believer?
I was definitely, when Nancy and I got back together, I really didn't have much of an idea that I was going to get back into music. Hmm. But it seemed like everybody that I was meeting at Costa Mesa, you know, was in the music business, you know, mm-hmm. and had little groups together. And so one thing led to another. And, you know, we did I've Got a Reason. And I mean, if you remember on a line in that album or on that song, is music was my life and finally took everything. Ain't it funny how you got it all and not a thing? And that's where I was at. And I was, you know, it was like I really didn't have any intentions of going back into music, but I did go after it with three albums with I've Got a Reason, Dance a Little Light, and I Still Have Dreams. And it just seemed like, you know, nothing would take off. It reached into the top 40, but even at that, you know, just nothing was really happening. And that's when, interestingly enough, I got a hold of Tom Stipe. And I told Tom, you know, hey, Tom, I'm not sure really what's going on here, but I think, you know, the Lord's leading me in some other directions. And I think, you know, maybe we might start a little home Bible study. And I think maybe, you know, we'll see where the Lord wants to go from there. He says, well, you know, man, that's a 10-year commitment.
That's 10 years.
I don't know if Tom ever remembered that. Yeah. Yeah. It was a lifelong commitment.
That's right, funny. Right, right.
So yeah. It was a 10-year
you know? Well, yeah. He was easy on us because 2 years into our commitment on his pastoral staff, and we had all this industry stuff that was happening, pulling us back into the entertainment field.
And we took Tom Muriel out to dinner.
Yeah, and they sent us packing with blessings. So what does that say about us?
We said we feel the Lord's calling us back to Hollywood, and we thought they were going to go ballistic, you know, and. Tom gave me some of the best advice.
Yes,
he says,
did.
You know what, Dan? He says, you should go. Mm-hmm. He says, there's a lot of people who God is calling to be a pastor, but there's few that are calling them to be Christians in the entertainment industry in Hollywood.
I know when I became a pastor, I mean, I had all the encouragement from so many of my pastor friends in California. I mean, from Greg and Lori right. Just people that were just, I mean, Mike Mack, and they were all just encouraging me, mm-hmm. you know, to don't let music go, man. God's given you a gift and talent, so don't let that go as well. With the church, it was maybe a little different situation at the first, you know, because they were afraid for their pastor to be, you know, to be going off into the world doing things. They thought, oh man, mm-hmm. this is a double-minded man, you know, unstable in all of his ways, and this and that and the other. And it was a struggle at first. As the church and as churches do, as they overturn and people get to know you even better, or the church becomes more of a family situation, because our church has never been really big, was never big out here. It was about, you know, I mean, 250 at the most, you know. Mm-hmm. But people would come and they would see us play, and they would see that our testimony never changed.
Going back to your album, I've Got a Reason, this was profoundly impactful in the life of my husband. I want you to tell that, hon.
Yeah.
Because I just want you to know that it was so instrumental in my life as well.
Yeah. Well, I've told you this a couple times, Richie. I don't know if Nancy's heard it, but in early 77, I was playing the Troubadour. I was playing all the clubs doing comedy. And I felt this what I later interpreted, the voice of the Lord saying, you need to seek God. You need to seek a relationship. Mm. And I looked at the Baha'i faith, found it empty. I looked into spiritualism, found it empty. And then being a real folk rock fan, I heard Jackson Browne's album. I've got a Pretender. And I just wore that out. It's a masterpiece album, but it's all about disillusionment. Mm-hmm. It's all about follow your dreams until they shatter. It was basically, you know, just live your life and then you fall off a cliff and there's no purpose or meaning. And then we got in I've Got a Reason. And I knew you because of Poco and Buffalo Springfield. So I immediately, and then I wore out your record. And it had such a profound effect because it was such a unique counterpoint to the Pretender. And it was saying, I've got a reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've got a reason. And that's what I was looking for. I wasn't in crisis. I was looking for purpose in life, for meaning. And then shortly thereafter, I came to the Lord. But so it had such an impact when I, you know, came to the Lord. And the thing about it is, and I know you and I have talked, you know, sometimes you wonder. I remember those are the days that with a Christian album, sometimes Christians would count the times you said Jesus in the lyrics. And if you didn't meet a quota, I know they did it with our records. If you didn't meet a quota, it wasn't Christian, you know.
Thanks, but, Don.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
But one of the things that really resonated with me was it wasn't an overtly, you know, in your face, but it was doing what Jesus did with the parables.
Yes.
It gave me a glimpse of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
It said, praise in this, Lord. You know, in this mm-hmm. album, I'm giving you glimpses of what it is to be a child of God mm-hmm. living in the kingdom life.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you publicly.
And I want to thank you. It is part of this testimony. Always.
I want to thank you too. I mean, just for giving me that encouragement, because sometimes, you know, you just don't know if you're having an impact on anyone's life with what you say. And I know that album, the word Jesus isn't on that album any place, but it's all over the album. He is all over that album. And a lot of it has to do with Nancy's and my working through the things or from my perspective, what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I remember David Geffen asking me when I was recording it, because we'd left SHF and still had a commitment. So I was making my commitment to him. You're not going to give me any of that Jesus music, are you? And I said, you know, David, I think these songs you're going to really appreciate, you know, and the album got reviewed quite well,
mm-hmm.
but it became, I found myself again between a rock and a hard place, because here you are pioneering. That's what Poco did. We pioneered. Mm-hmm. We dug up the fallow ground, you know, and then along comes the Eagles, you know, and they become, well, you know, I'm plowing some ground, because in 1976, there weren't a lot of people who were really doing albums like I did mm-hmm. with I've Got a Reason. And I found myself, I was too Jesus for the world and not enough Jesus for the Christian community. And it kind of like, that was kind of like where that album sat for all those years.
Nancy, this time you've been married to this guy who's been really famous in the music world, legendary musician, and now you actually probably somewhat what pastor's wives feel, in a sense that once again, he's on another platform. How did you manage that transition? Did you feel that you still had a voice, or did you feel, what was that like?
I don't know. It just kind of, I don't like the word, but it kind of evolved.
Yeah. Nice.
I never felt like I needed to be seen, or I'm his wife, and mm-hmm. I don't know, I've never wanted the spotlight. It took, when we first had church, I don't know how many years it was before we had a women's Bible study, I knew that God wanted me to lead it, but I was so hesitant and so nervous and, you know, just shy to do that, that I balked at it. you know, and then finally I did it and I loved it.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
It became more flourishing ministry in our church.
Really?
That's amazing. Amazing. And so your children have had to adjust to the stage of their father as well. What, I mean, he's got a mic on the music stage. Now he's got a mic in the pulpit.
You
so
know, I don't think any of them even think about it. To be honest with you. I mean, do you? I mean, Jessie may a little bit because she sings with him.
Yes.
She's
right.
Our youngest. Yes. I mean, I don't know. He's just Papa, you know? I mean, he's not.
You know, it's sweet to hear that because I thought that would most likely be what you would share only because in watching what I've read about Jessie, it's like that when a child embraces what their father's doing rather than seeing as something that took him away from me, and obviously that took encouragement on your part too, Richie. Yeah. And that's a place in her life, that beautiful word over her.
Yeah.
And is there a greater pleasure than working with your kids?
Oh, if Jessie would not have been traveling with me over the last 10 years or so, I wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
It was the one thing that really broke up our family for a while. Because, see, Nancy and I both, my dad died when I was 13. She was 7 when her dad died.
Wow.
So we both didn't have father figures, basically, in our... I mean, we did up to a certain time. And when everything split up, I mean, I think I was thinking I was providing for everything that she needed. I mean, we had a home, a nice home. We had nice cars. Mm-hmm. We had all the clothes and food and this and that on it, you know. And, mm-hmm. but what I wasn't there. That's what she wanted. And I didn't mm-hmm. know that. I thought I was fulfilling everything that I was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And so that took, you know, the whole work of coming together and figuring out, you know, how do we make this thing work to move on once we got back together. And after that, I didn't think I was ever going on the road again. I thought when I became a believer and became a pastor that was it. And, you know, when we did in my father's house, it was a turning point for some reason as far as going out and making music again. But I had to find the balance, you know, where I wouldn't be gone for long periods of time ever. Number one, I had not only the family, but I had the church that was my responsibility. So I had to balance all of that stuff out. And I think that partially was part of what kind of held it all together, making it work, you know, is that you wouldn't go out for long periods of time.
Yes.
And, you know, and again, you know, with having 4 kids, you know, Nancy couldn't go out on the road with me a lot. So that's another reason why I just refused to go out a lot.
Yes.
You know, being a pastor for 35 years and then going out and playing music the latter part, probably the last, you know, 20 years of that.
We can relate to that because it has been media and ministry hand in hand our whole life. Sometimes, you know, those 3 years in Colorado, ministry. Right?
Yep.
And then, but it has gone back and forth. And that, Dan, with Master Media, now that's we get to go encourage the hearts of those who see their profession as missional.
Well, in 1997, Buffalo Springfield gets inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Ohio.
In Ohio.
That's where the Hall of Fame is. And what did that mean to you?
Obviously, to be honored and inducted into the Hall of Fame, I mean, it's a great honor. You know, you see your name written up there in that one little place up there with Elvis Presley or with Ricky Nelson. I want to say that, yes, it's quite an honor. To think that, you know, I could go from Yellow Springs, Ohio to New York City, being a folk singer and playing rock and roll music to being a pastor and inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's an honor. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But you know what? It's a fleeting moment and that's it.
But you were really an architect that helped, you know, really develop the country rock style that went on to be the Eagles.
Sure.
Jackson Brown, Linda Ronstadt, all those.
Yeah.
So, that it's so funny. You, like you said, you don't even realize you're just following what this unction.
He's doing it. We're just doing it. You know, I didn't think, okay, Jimmy, we're going to go plow some ground now for the Eagles who will be coming along in a couple of years. No, we were making music that touched our hearts, and that's what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Build an audience at the Troubadour, and from there we went on, you know. And, you're just doing – it wasn't contrived to the point, you know, I mean, from yes. Springfield to Poco to anything, we just did what was, it was natural to us.
Right.
We never
right.
had to be, you do what somebody, we want you to sound like so-and-so. We want, you know, you,
that's
never happened. You know, we were always pioneering. We were always starting the you know, whatever yeah. we did.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up, I want to circle back to Laurel Canyon and talk to you about the role music plays in our cultural narrative. You know, time in the 60s, a lot of turmoil, a lot of division, a lot of things going on, and Buffalo Springfield literally alerted the nation, there's something happening here, you know, and we
an
are
anthem.
An anthem, and we're in similar times now. We were very, very polarized, a lot of angry voices, and then pandemic hits, and now we're quarantined, and we're out of our social rhythms, and then the tragedy of mm-hmm. the George Floyd death, mm-hmm. which alerted the nation to, we better deal with racism. Mm-hmm. It's been lingering since before the foundations of the nation. Mm-hmm. So as a Christian, how do you see the role of music in speaking to what is going on culturally in any given time?
Well, music is a universal language. I mean, it doesn't matter if people understand, you know, English or whatever, you know, it's music. I think God created it so that, you know, our spirits would be touched. And you know, some people are touched by lyrics first. Some people are attracted to the rhythm. Some people are attracted to the melody, you know, but it's like all together, it becomes a universal language. Now, yes. What you do with that, you know, is something else. You know, there are those, I believe, that everybody will personally probably use that to their own benefit, however they're viewing what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, like protest music, well, that's all folk music was a lot of times. It was just protest yeah. music, you know?
Right.
I didn't realize that at the time.
Yeah, and poetry.
Yeah, but that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And boy, you know, you talked about living in some pretty dangerous times today, man. I think it's more dangerous today than it was in the 60s. How we navigate through it, the only way we can do it is to keep our eyes on Jesus. If we didn't keep our eyes on Jesus, you know, we'd be wandering aimlessly without purpose or direction constantly.
It's pretty remarkable mm-hmm. how God continues to speak. Through song.
Well, we're so thankful for you guys. We're yes. thankful for your music, which you have dedicated to the Lord, mm-hmm. and it speaks hope, it speaks faith, it speaks that there is a reason way beyond, you know, our purposes of mankind. And we appreciate who you yes. are as believers, as a married couple, as parents, as grandparents, mm-hmm. and we just love you guys and are so thankful we had this time to talk.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. You know, God has blessed us. I mean, 53 years for us, 4 daughters, 3 grand, or 3 son-in-laws, and 13 grandkids.
What?
Wow.
What?
So,
the joy of our life.
Yeah.
We've got 7 and
awesome.
Flip the cards.
It's so good.
Well, we're grateful that, and Nancy too.
Thank you yes. so much. It's been a wonderful time. Thank you so much. Bless you.
Oh. Bless you.
We'll be praying for this, all these going out to just touch people's lives, man. It's a great way to just reach out.
Yes. Thank you so
Amen.
Much. We appreciate
Bless
it.
You.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for Life Off Screen with Dan and Peggy Ruppel. Life Off Screen is produced by Master Media International. Our technical director is Jason Rugg. Please subscribe to the Life Off Screen YouTube channel or subscribe to the Life Off Screen podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave your comments in the comment section. And to find out more about Master Media, go to mastermedia.com. Thanks again for joining us. Hope to see you next time.